Hello, I'm Sami Zeidan. This is Counting the Costs on Al Jazeera, your look at the world of business and economics. This week, rivers drying up and farmland parched. How will extreme drought in Europe impact the cost of living crisis? Also this week, millions of young people around the world expected to be jobless this year. What's delaying the recovery in youth employment? And a year after the Taliban took power in Afghanistan, its economic crisis is worsening. What can the group do to turn things around? Scientists warn it could become Europe's worst drought in more than 500 years. Water scarcity has hit more than 60% of the continent, from Italy to the UK. An unusually dry winter and scorching summer heat have reduced rivers to trickles. The historic water reserve lows have forced governments to restrict supplies. Well, that shortage is seriously affecting nearly everything from agriculture to the shipping industry. Bernard Smith looks at the impact in Toulouse in southwestern France.
I've never seen the river as low as this, Stefan Marty tells me. He's a fisheries officer. In a normal year, the level of the Garonne here would be above our heads. The river cuts through Toulouse. It's the city's lifeblood, providing drinking water, irrigating farmland and cooling a nuclear plant. Stefan has had to take fish out of the river and put them into special tanks because the water is too warm.
It's complicated. Everything is connected. There will be less snow in the mountains. The glaciers will melt sooner. This year there has been much less snow, so less water in the mountain lakes. So pumping of the lakes is lower to keep the water longer.
Over 3 weeks, 40% of the water held in reserve in hydroelectric dams in the Pyrenees Mountains has been released into the Garonne to keep it flowing. Just. Heat waves in Europe are increasing at a faster rate than almost anywhere else on the planet. And global warming increases the likelihood of drought, drying out soils and vegetation.
Là, il va nous falloir minimum 60 millimètres pour pouvoir reprendre les sols après la moisson.
We need 60 millimetres of rainfall to be able to replant the soil, Christelle Carpentier tells me. The forecast is for 3 millimetres this week. It's not enough.
No.
The corn harvest across France is expected to be 18.5% lower this year than last. There's already a global shortage because of the war in Ukraine. Even the sunflowers have turned away from the scorching sun. Where there is access to water, there isn't enough to go around. Christelle says she'll lose more than 30% of her crop this year.
If we don't get enough water in this region, there will be no viable agriculture. Even today, the cattle farmers here have no grass on their fields. Today, we are on a land where it's crucial to develop irrigation, if only to be able to achieve minimum profitability.
France's worst drought since records began in 1958 has affected so many aspects of how people live here.
And I think we will walk a lot. We will train the kayak and we will walk because there is not enough water for the floating.
In July, rainfall across France was down 84% compared to normal, according to the French Weather Service. The summer isn't over yet. Bernard Smith, Al Jazeera, Toulouse, southwest France.
Well, joining us from Munich now is Dr. Miranda Schruers, Chair of Environmental and Climate Policy at the Technical University of Munich. Good to have you with us. So Europe has seen drought before, but let's put it into perspective. How big of a challenge is this one?
This is a very major drought that is impacting Europe right now. As much as 47% of the European continent is in some level of drought danger. Of that 47%, about 17% is considered in severe drought right now, and the other areas are moving in that direction. So we haven't seen droughts like this too often. 2018 was a very, very bad drought year. 2018 was considered a 1-in-500-year drought. This is a second 1-in-500-year drought. And this means that Europe needs to prepare for a different kind of climate in the future.
And now we're seeing the transport of coal. We're seeing those hydropower plants, nuclear plants. They're also being impacted by this drought, right? What's that going to mean for an already critical European energy situation?
You are so right. Right now, the rivers in Europe are at historic lows. The Po River in Italy, the Rhine River traveling from Switzerland through the Netherlands. And the water is so low that we are no longer able to transport many kinds of materials by barge, which means that they have to be shipped by a truck or by rail, which adds to the costs of shipping. Sometimes materials can't be shipped at all right now. So this is an added challenge on top of the prices that are skyrocketing because of the war in the Ukraine and the limited gas supplies from Russia right now. So this is a very challenging time for the European continent, and we're going to definitely see some very heavy costs associated with this drought.
Well, you mentioned there the rising costs, transport, that's going to go on and be passed on to goods, right? What is that going to mean for people who are already struggling with the rising cost of living?
Well, of course, this has us very worried. Energy poverty is already a concern because of the war in the Ukraine and the increase in gas and oil and coal prices. It also means that now food prices will become more expensive, goods and materials will become more expensive. So this really emphasizes for us right now taking every step possible to be more resource efficient. And it also means we're going to have to do some planning for the future.
And you mentioned shipping there also getting impacted. What is that going to mean for the already complicated situation with supply chains?
Yes, this is, again, just an added crisis on top of other crises. So right now, we are seeing worldwide problems with supply chains, difficulties in moving goods. It's partly the COVID problem, for example, in China. It's partly energy costs. And so this is really making it difficult for many firms that simply aren't getting the supplies they need to be able to produce their products. And we are hearing about factories that are having to go into temporary stop in terms of production simply because they're not getting the parts that they need to continue with production.
I'm not going to at all ask you for too much. Just bring out your magic wand now and tell us what's the solution for all of this. Are European governments doing the right things?
I think Europe is just now waking up to the reality that we don't only need an energy transition, we're going to need a water management transition. We haven't really prepared Europe for the droughts that seem to be coming more and more frequently. So I don't think there's a single easy solution, but we're going to have to be better at saving water. We're going to have to be better at recycling water. We're going to have to develop more cooling systems so that people have places to escape to when it's too hot. Europe needs to rethink what the climate is going to be like in the years ahead. And it's not just Europe, it will be other parts of the world as well.
I wonder what that means then for, I mean, if this is going to go on for a while, as you indicated there, there isn't a simple solution. What does that mean? Are we looking at inflation? Are we looking at recession for a while then?
Well, of course, the hope is that the drought will break. Probably for the next couple of months, it's going to remain very challenging. We saw in 2018 between a 10 and 30% loss in agricultural sector due to the drought. Estimates are that just the impact of the low water levels in the Rhine River could cost the German economy as much as 0.2% of the annual economy. So the impacts are indeed huge. And if this is not just a single 1-in-500-year event, but something that we're going to start to see numerous times every decade, we need to rethink a lot of things. And it really points to just how important it is that we develop circular economies, resource-efficient economies, water-efficient economies. We've been pushing the planet to its limits, and we're starting to feel the price.
All right. Lovely talking to you, Dr. Miranda.
Thank you very much.
It's not just in Europe. Parts of the Western United States are also in the grip of a 23-year drought. That's the worst on record. And taps are running dry in Mexico too. Just 10% of dams across the country are full. The water crisis has reached critical levels in Mexico's wealthiest city. Manuel Rapala reports from Monterrey.
Extreme drought conditions in northern Mexico. This reservoir in the outskirts of Monterrey is almost entirely dry. And many here worry the same will happen to the local economy.
I worry over another week of this. Things would only worsen.
Boats are now stranded atop the dry lake bed at La Boca Dam. It's been months since the region has seen any significant rainfall.
Experts have identified several factors that are contributing to the ongoing water crisis here in northern Mexico, the most significant of which is a weather phenomenon known as La Niña, which climate scientists say has been exacerbated by climate change, leading to one of the worst droughts in the last 30 years.
Scientists say La Niña has disrupted regular weather patterns in northern Mexico. This means that rains that were supposed to begin in May still haven't arrived, and there's no telling when they will. Environmental activists say that despite the drought, bottling companies like Coca-Cola, Heineken, and others have continued large-scale water extraction, making the situation even worse.
We're living a great contradiction in this city. We owe a great deal to the big companies, but it's been at the cost of the well-being of citizens, and that's a problem. We need to completely rethink the question of water usage.
The water crisis in Monterrey, a city of more than 5 million people, has reached a critical point. Many now rely almost entirely on public water tanks. For some, they are the only source of water available.
We have no water. Nothing comes out of the tap, and we have to carry it back home for cooking, cleaning, and even the bathroom. We buy our drinking water from the supermarket.
Mexico's president has vowed to continue to support efforts to supply water to various cities in northern Mexico. But experts say the strategy is not sustainable, adding that the only real solution is rain. Manuel Rapalo, Al Jazeera, Monterrey.
Many people were forced out of the labor market or unable to enter it because of restrictions during the height of the pandemic. Now, with much of the world getting back to business, the International Labour Organization says the global job market will take longer than expected to recover. About 207 million people are expected to be unemployed this year. But young people could be affected the most. The ILO says the pandemic has disproportionately impacted job opportunities for youths. The UN Labour Agency estimates the total global number of unemployed youths will reach 73 million this year. That's a slight improvement from last year's levels, but the ILO says unemployment remains 6 million above 2019 figures before the pandemic started. Just over 27% of young women are likely to find a job this year, compared to at least 40% of young men. Recovery in youth unemployment is expected to be more successful in high-income countries than in low- and middle-income ones. Almost 13% of young people are without jobs in Africa. But the continent is not the worst performer. Arab countries have the world's highest and fastest-growing unemployment rate of young people. Almost a quarter of Arab youths are unemployed. Well, joining us now from Geneva is Ki-Bom Kim, a macroeconomic and employment policy specialist at the International Labour Organization. Good to have you with us. So why are young people in particular, Ki, being impacted in the job market?
Well, you know, there's a lot of there's a variety of reasons. I think, first of all, it's important to bear in mind that young people were disproportionately in the sectors hardest hit by the pandemic. So these sectors include, for example, you know, food, accommodation, hospitality. And of course, you know, consequently, since then, we've had quite a bit of uncertainty economic-wise. So we've seen, for example, you know, this year, international organizations repeatedly lowering growth, economic growth forecasts. And young people in this kind of uncertainty and fragility are, you know, it's not good news for them.
Is there a problem as well with training, education?
We've had, you know, deep disruptions in training education, which can lead to learning losses. And these learning losses, of course, can have scarring effects over an individual's entire life cycle, either through lower lifetime earnings or lower career trajectories. Also, we've seen, for example, that in some socioeconomic settings, we've seen girls, you know, are the first to be pulled out of school and the last to return. And so these disruptions to girls will have negative implications on gender inequality in the labor market.
All right. At the end of this pandemic, we're seeing, of course, a trend of people working from home, a speeding up of the sort of transition to more sustainable economies. Is that going to help bring more people into the job market?
In fact, yes. You know, I think of course, you know, countries need to continue to focus on, addressing the impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic, because in one way, form or another, they continue to linger. But I think countries also need to, you know, to not lose sight of longer term priorities. And so we have found, for example, that, you know, in our work, that the digital economy, the care economy, the green and blue economies, as well as the creative economies, can provide a potentially large number of jobs for young people. We, you know, for example, our modeling work, for example, finds that the transition to these economies can lead to an additional job gain of about 139 million. In jobs, you know, a quarter of which would be taken up by young people between the ages of 15 and 29.
And you mentioned the issue with schooling for girls. Are we seeing the trend of gender disparities, regional differences getting worse?
I mean, from the pandemic, you know, initially from the pandemic, we have, the gender inequalities in the labor market as well as in education worsened. But we have to actually also bear in mind, for example, that, we've had a recovery since then. And so in some country settings, and it's difficult to generalize, but in some country settings, for example, young women or girls have benefited more. But I think it's important to bear in mind that there are large gender gaps even before the crisis, which have been exacerbated initially. But then there's still a lot of ground to be made up, even though in some countries, we have come quite a bit further.
Talking about some countries or some regions, why are Arab states the worst performers when it comes to the world's unemployment, youth unemployment hotspot?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. The first of which is, of course, is just a demographic issue. There's a large, a fast-growing young population in the Arab states. The second is, in terms of youth unemployment, a lot of that is accounted by young women. So, for example, rates of unemployment among young women are double, that of young men. And so there is that issue. And the third, I think, is a very important issue, is that, the educational attainment in the Arab states, has really progressed at a much faster degree than economic structures have changed. And so you find a lot of well-educated people that want good jobs, but these good jobs are not necessarily available.
And when we take into consideration global migration patterns and so on, is Africa's youth unemployment problem really a global problem?
Indeed. I mean, Africa is what the fastest growing population, amongst regions. And so youth unemployment or underemployment in Africa, will have, can have serious repercussions, more broadly. But I think it's important to bear in mind that unemployment is only, the tip of the iceberg. There's, for example, in Africa, there are, more challenges, for example, in terms of working poverty, for example, in terms of underemployment. And what we see, for example, in Africa during the pandemic is that unemployment did not rise a lot simply because in order to be unemployed, one has to be looking for a job. But a lot of people, once they started to look for a job, during the pandemic and consequently, they realized that there are not that many jobs out there. And so they became discouraged. And in fact, these discouraged job seekers, they're no longer considered statistically as unemployed. They're now out of the labor force. They're considered inactive. And so what we have seen, for example, in the case of Africa, but also in other regions, is that the labor market impact of the pandemic has really been through, this high rise in inactivity, a lot of discouraged job seekers, rather than a big rise in unemployment.
Interesting. Thanks so much for chatting with us, Key.
Thank you very much.
Decades of war, years of drought, and now Western sanctions have devastated Afghanistan's economy. A year after the Taliban took power, The country's finances have all but collapsed after the flow of foreign aid slowed to a trickle. Many Afghans can't afford basic goods, and about half the population doesn't have enough food. Hundreds of thousands of people are jobless. Businesses are struggling because of a lack of access to funds and foreign currency. The UN describes the situation as pure catastrophe. And it says only 40% of the money required to fund humanitarian help has been received so far. Aid accounted for 80% of the Afghan state budget, but it was cut off after the Taliban's takeover. The US and Europe blocked more than $9 billion in central bank reserves as part of sanctions on the group. Economists say the measures have worsened the country's economic crisis and are calling for the funds to be released. Taliban critics say it's failed to reverse the country's financial woes, but the group is pointing to improvements made under its watch. Al Jazeera spoke to Ahmed Wali Hakmal, the spokesperson of the Ministry of Finance, about the challenges ahead.
One of the biggest problems that we are facing economically and financially is the restriction on our banking system. The problem is that the world has politicized economy and finance. And economy and finance are, you know, dealing with common people, which is harming all common peoples. But still, we are in talks with them, in dialogues, and even the Treasury Department of U.S. has had some licenses which decreased the restrictions on our banking system, but still we urged to eliminate all restrictions on our banking systems.
Now, the Taliban says it's generating its own revenues and aims to meet its fiscal target for this year.
Our annually budget, which we made it, is the first budget in 20 years, which is completely dependent on our own revenues. It is about $2.5 billion, and we believe till the end of our fiscal year, we can erase what we have forecasted in our budget. We have generated about $800 million from customs, $400 million from non-tax revenues, which mostly come from mines, and about $300 million from taxes. And just some organization have paid a very small number of salaries.
Many Afghans say their earnings were depleted due in part to inconsistent salary payments. Hakmal says the group has been paying wages on time and looking to the private sector to help people find jobs.
People shouldn't be dependent just on government. We need to create jobs in private sector. And we have a good connection with our private sectors and facilitating them the rules and regulations, providing them what they need. We are a rich country naturally, but also have lots of land for agricultural. So we have to work in every single part, facilitate regulation for foreign investments, work for our agricultural. And you know, you have to work in all parts, and we are doing that. But the thing is, if you want to bring a change, it will take time.
The Ministry of Finance is challenging international organizations to audit its claims the country is now corruption-free.
Corruption was a big problem, and I can say that the system was, especially Ministry of Finance, before us was even over-corrupted. At the other hand, the tolerance of Emirates for corruption is zero. We took strong steps to stop corruptions, bring changes in the leadership of the government, and found that gaps of corruptions, which were there in system, found that and eliminated those. So now we can say that we are a corruption-free country, and we are ready for any international organizations, International Transparent or others, to come and see the level of corruption, that how we minimize it.
And that's our show for this week. But remember, you can get in touch with us via Twitter. Use the hashtag AJCTC when you do, or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. There's more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. That's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Sami Zeidan from the whole team here. Thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.